KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. You can also hear the show at kcrw.com. When last my guest, actor, comedian, and author Russell Brand was here, he was here with My Bookie Wook. This time he's here with My Bookie Wook 2. This time it's personal, presumably because Electric Boogaloo was taken. Russell, so good to have you back. Thanks for coming back.
Thank you, Elvis. Thank you for having me. It was a great pleasure to speak with you last time. I'm very happy to talk with you again. And already you've started by pointing out the humorous connotations of the tagline. Rejected were Bookie Wook 2, Pig in the City. Bookie Wook 2, The Legend of Curly's Gold. Bookie Wook 2, First Blood. Thank you very much. Thank you. Yeah.
Because I was wondering how you decided about a title. I know it's a dumb, obvious question, but it was the first thing that came to me for this time around.
A lot of people think that a Bookie Wook, call in your autobiography, My Bookie Wook, is puerile, and those people are in a way correct, but it was always a reference to Anthony Burgess and the way that the droogs talk in Clockwork Orange, eggy wegs, oh my gutty wuts are all squirty. That language, the white noise of language, perhaps one of the most potent tools we have as human beings, becomes redundant and irrelevant when words like magnificent are used to describe yogurt, life-changing, fizzy drinks, happiness with Coca-Cola, just do it with Nike. That language becomes this sort of redundant. The power of these vibrations is increasingly homogenized and reduced. So calling something My Bookie Wook, I think, is sort of playful and silly. And like the first book was full of sort of towers of addiction and devastation and abuse, and there's this sort of desolate moral wasteland that was my soul at that time. So having sort of a jocular, light-hearted title, it seemed apposite to me. And with the second book, I wanted to echo the nature of sequels and also to make light of the deep intimacy of the first book.
Well, but I think there's intimacy here too, because early on in the book, at one point, your manager, John Knoll, says to you, you put together a family, maybe not the family you always wanted, but a family, which as compared to the really sort of solo nature of the first book. This book is really about acquiring people in your orbit, isn't it?
I think my early life was defined by this imposed solipsism, a gulag of one, where I was the jailer and the prisoner and had Stockholm syndrome with myself, imprisoned in my own mind. And now I have, garnered a tribe around me. Like I feel sort of unified. I work with a group of people who are like my dearest, closest friends. I'm getting married. I've fallen in love. And now I feel, much more... I don't feel so isolated. I don't feel so insular. I feel sort of connected both with other people, but also with something higher. I have a sense of connection that I think was absent for much of my early life that was defined by addiction and self-destruction.
But I think also, too, there is a need to share some part of yourself. And as we go on through the book, it's about you picking up new family members and having to lose some family members over some controversies. So there is, I think sort of self-knowledge that comes across in this book than in the first book.
Yes, I think from a practical perspective, I hope I've grown as a writer. I think it's a funnier book. I think it's better written than the first book. It perhaps doesn't have the jarring drama of a man incrementally killing himself with drugs and the sort of the explosive controversies. But it's very much like a tale of fame and the contemporary drama of modern fame, this glistening, visceral experience of fame, something utterly superficial and vacuous and yet so profound. And for me, in terms of the development of an individual, I feel that what you're saying is important, Elvis, about family and connection, because I feel the illusion of separation is that this is an important thing, an important theme of our times. Me, as I get closer to the people around me, as I fall more and more in love with the person that I want to spend the rest of my life with, I recognise that by loving one person, you know, like in Schindler's List, it goes, he who saves one life saves the world entire. If you learn to love yourself and learn to love one other individual, I think within that you recognise the capacity to love all people. You recognise the capacity for connection within us all, and the illusion of separation begins to erode. You know, that sort of, I think whoever you spoke to, like, you know, in that, when we give in to sort of immediate sensory rejections of people, he stepped on my toe, he cut me up, he pulled in front of that traffic light. Whoever these individuals are, if you spent a bit of time with them, I think you'd end up going, oh, he's all right, really. No one's that bad. Give us a cuddle.
It's The Treatment. I'm talking to the author of Bookie Wook 2. This time it is personal, Russell Brand. But apropos of that, when you hosted the MTV Awards and you got in some trouble, you began an internet dialogue with White Boy. Speaking of that, the kind of person who might...
Ah, yes. Due to my appearance at the MTV VMA Awards and some humorous comments I made, I think I misjudged the American cultural landscape as an Englishman abroad. You know, so like, I said, like, oh, George W. Like, the joke that caused the offence was, I'm here to urge you on behalf of the world to elect Barack Obama. Some people, racists, I think they're called, say America is not ready for a black president. But I know America to be a free-thinking, forward-thinking, liberal country. After all, you've had that retarded cowboy fella in the White House for 8 years. We thought that was very liberal to let him have a go, because in my country he wouldn't be trusted with a pair of scissors, right? And like, I thought that's funny, people are going to love that. And some people did, but like, some people responded to that with death threats, Elvis. They said, we are going to kill you. We will kill you for saying that.
But you began, or rather you commenced a dialogue with some of these people. And you must have learned that part of the thing is half the time they don't expect to hear back from anybody.
This is true. I think this is the assumption. I think, you know, the internet has afforded this ubiquitous anonymity. We can sling out these threats. I think that's why there's so much vitriol on the internet. Never look at the comments made about you online unless you are ready for some coruscating self-loathing from the perspective of another. You know, because like, people are like, there's just hatred in there. Like, White Boy was, yeah, I'm going to kill you, I'm going to kill you. So I just responded, well, thank you, White Boy, for your comments. And I sort of thought, why not engage in a Bronte-esque dialogue? This can be like the great correspondences of Freud and Jung. Two minds searching for new outreaches of the capacity of human interest. Yes, we're coming at this from a different perspective, but we'll find an ultimate truth. You and me, White Boy.
So you were looking for synchronicity with White Boy.
I think ultimately the synchronicity is always there. We all just have to uncover it. Ultimately, me and White Boy are part of the same consciousness experiencing itself. So all I have to remove is the superficial differences between me and White Boy. White Boy looks at the world this way, I look at it thusly, but ultimately we are one. White Boy was operating under the misapprehension that I would be fiercely loyal to my own government in the United Kingdom. Well, I don't have much time for them either. I don't care who's peddling lies, what colour they are, what accent they've got. If you're peddling lies, you're peddling lies.
It's The Treatment. The White Boy I'm talking to now is Russell Brand, whose new memoir is Bookie Wook 2. This time it's personal. You can also hear the show at KCRW.com. But I just thought that, it's funny, I don't mean to digress, but as you talk about this, I think about this, the great line of C.S. Lewis where he said, you don't have a soul, you are a soul, you have a body. Mm. And for some reason that came to mind just sitting here talking to you.
Oh, that's beautiful, isn't it? But that is, that we see like our soul as some abstract thing that we occasionally glimpse and are given access to. But that is our defining quality, that this is what we should live in service of. But that's why, that's a really difficult thing, isn't it, Elvis? Like, sort of, like, you know, sometimes I feel, when I come on the programme like yours, I feel sometimes disingenuous because I'm obviously highlighting the most attractive aspects of me. I think, oh, I'll come across as erudite and I've got a good vocabulary and I'm a good man and I'm a caring man and I want to improve myself and I want to be loving and I want to be beautiful to people. But also I'm selfish and I'm greedy and I'm vain and I want attention. I don't bring that up when I'm talking to Elvis Mitchell. I don't say to people, I want women to find me attractive. I want men to admire me. And this is because I suppose, you know, within us all, we have this divinity. We are souls. And please don't co-join that. Don't conjugate that, Elvis. But I think the reason that there's this, I have this feeling of hypocrisy sometimes is because in the cultural environment, environment that I live, in which I was bred, in which I was raised, what are the traits that are fated and celebrated? It's kind of self-fulfillment, vanity. You know, we live in a culture of the celebration of the individual, self-infatuation, self-entitlement. I think the incredible, like, American literary movement of the 50s, like the Beats, that begat the hippie culture and collided with Eastern philosophy and had this the wonderful moment in time where we could change the world. We can do what we want. Through the 80s and through mainstream culture and the mainstream consumption of counterculture became we can do what we want, became I can do what I want. They once again, the mainstream found a way of commodifying and selling back to us.
But more importantly, and you're talking about dealing with this in terms of I can own what I want, and if it's about ownership and purchase,
yes,
then you have to sort of... You mentioned the Beats, and you have to remember that word came from people who were beat down.
Yes.
People who were discarded by the mainstream,
yes,
and made their own way. And it seems like you were trying to be that person in the mainstream, though.
Yes, this is what I've always wondered. I've always wondered if the language of commerce can be used to propagate spiritual ideas. If we can, like, you know, see, this is the thing that makes me optimistic, Elvis. People want Nike shoes, but for me, what's important about that is people want. And, like, you know, but at the moment, there's attention is drawn to Nike shoes. Someone once told me that all desire is the inappropriate substitute for the desire to be at one with God. So our desires are directed towards product. They're directed towards self-satisfaction. But what is this desire really? What is it at its core? It's a desire to be at union, to be at one, to discover wholeness, for the realization of the soul, the C.S. Lewis quote that you just brought to mind. It's about this spiritual union. This is what we're hankering after. This is what we're craving. Now, the people sort of currently that dominate us, that govern us, their interests are to mainline money to a small percentage of the population, to mainline control to a small percentage of the population. But I think these ideas or this facility, this paradigm can be used to bring enlightenment.
No, it's funny because this book, as much as more than the first one, in fact, is about that division in you. That side, that those questions you're asking yourself. Well, how do I serve and find this bigger world to be a part of? And as I'm acquiring a family, but also I'm a man of, as Robert E. Howard described Conan the Barbarian, enormous mirth and enormous melancholy. So if you're pursuing that kind of thing for yourself, and you're trying to build a family, how do you keep these two elements together? That's really the core question of the book, isn't it?
I think it is the core question of the book and perhaps the core question of all books. How do we, as Morrissey said, does the mind rule the body or does the body rule the mind? I don't know. I don't know. You know, we live in service of the senses and service of the soul. Like, whilst I'm a man craving enlightenment and looking for spiritual truth, I still stay in 5-star hotels. I still care about the clothes I wear.
But that's a great line you actually have in the book. You say, well, if you thought someplace, the best accommodation someplace had was basically a box in the street, you'd be fine with it. But you found out somebody had a box with a smelly blanket in it, then you'd be upset with yourself.
Yes.
The idea that somebody's living better than you.
I have this reference anxiety, I believe it's called, the knowledge that there are people that, you know, life is elsewhere. The idea that someone somewhere is having a better experience of life, I think tortures us. And that's why I think celebrity culture is so corrosive and damaging, because we're constantly bombarded with these images of luxury. You know, I go to film premieres and stuff. It's not that good. You know, it's a bit boring. You know, I make films. It's not as good as I thought it would be when I was a kid. But constantly, you're presented with that vision. Oh, this is what you want. This is what you should be craving. But there's nothing in it. There's no nutrition. But it's very hard to let go of it because every billboard you look at, every TV channel, every radio show you listen to, every hip-hop track, it's a celebration of these ideas. It's all pervasive. And I'm not claiming to be anything other than part of the problem. I'm part of it. I walk them red carpets. I take the money. I sit in them trailers. I make the movies, I present MTV award shows, but I'm just saying, I wonder if within it is possible to access something more truthful. I wonder. It's a question, not an answer.
That's a great question to take a break on. I'm here with Russell Brand. His new book is Bookie Work 2. This time it's personal. It's clearly very personal. It's the treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Welcome Back is The Treatment, which you can also hear at KCRW.com. My guest is actor, comedian, author, second-time author, Russell Brand. His new memoir is Bookie Wook 2. This time it's personal. One of the things, though, I wanted to ask you about, because you get at this in the book, the thing you're alluding to, saying in the first half of the show is about how you were achieving all these things, and yet you were not gaining the kind of fulfillment, or not even that, enlightenment, that seemed to be as much your appetite as the kind of sort of self-satisfaction.
I think it's the redirection of these appetites. You know, like, I think if you're... This is why addiction is interesting to me, because when you're a heroin addict, Elvis, as I was, it's you sort of think, you know, all of us, I think, have this sense that there is something that we are lacking, that something is missing, and it's been referred to by some as a God-shaped hole. You know, and like, so when you're a heroin addict, you sort of think, oh, I need something. But it's like, you know, in my first book, I relayed the anecdote given to me by a friend of mine about he was looking after this little boy who was 5. And this little boy would, like, you know, while he was babysitting the little boy went, I want something. Like, he didn't know if it was, I want to watch a cartoon, I want to bar a chocolate, I want to see my mum, I want to go out on my bike. He just knew that he wanted something. And when he was a little kid, he didn't know how to properly articulate that. When you're a junkie, you know what it is you want. It's heroin. I want heroin, because when you run low, when it's not in your blood, you get itchy and your legs get kicky and you start to get hot and cold and sweaty and anxious. And then suddenly, as you inhale, you are soothed and released. So it's a very simple and recognisable cycle. I need, I fulfil. I need, I fulfil. And I think we live in a society that functions on that basis. Advertising stimulates a need. You need Nike. You need Coca-Cola. Ah, I have it. And then you eat it. But then seconds later, you need it again. You need it again. So what I'm discovering is, now that I've been fulfilled in many areas, I thought I wanted to be famous. Now I am famous. I thought I wanted to have money. Now I have money. And I realised, no, that wasn't it. That wasn't it. Did you ever hear that Bob Dylan's ode to Woody Guthrie? When he talks about all the ways we try and fulfil ourselves, but somehow in Woody Guthrie's music, is this idea that really, without union, without sort of, you know, like who's that guy, Ram Dass? He said his guru said to him, like, that he was like ever troubling Ram Dass. Ram Dass was always troubling his guru in India. Oh, what is it? What is it? What should I do? What's my purpose? What's my function? And he said to him, feed and clothe the poor. That it's nothing more complicated than that. Like, you know, sort of you think it's about self-fulfillment, that it's about self-satisfaction, but the self is ultimately an illusion. So you can't ever find answers through fulfilling yourself. Yeah, you've got to not die. You've got to, like, fulfil these basic physiological functions of food, shelter, Maslow's pyramid of needs. Don't die. Don't let a dinosaur eat you. Make sure you have a sandwich. But beyond that, it's dopey. It's not going to do anything for you.
See, this is what's interesting to me, because each chapter of the book basically ends with you kind of getting a goal. Like, you talk about making one of the Adam Sandler movies, and there's this woman you pursued ardently, and you finally got her. But you could always see the light at the end of the tunnel. And each chapter of the book ends in that way.
Yes.
Now, I wonder what makes you decide to end almost each chapter like that, with you getting something that you wanted, but it not being enough.
The spectacle requires distance to remain enchanting. Once you are in the spectacle, once you're part of the spectacle, you realise that that's what it was. Just a superficial zoetrope, just a series of illusions. Once you're part of it, you can no longer be spellbound by it, because you recognise, oh, right, it's not real. It's only a dream. It's just a consensual mass illusion.
But you still pursue it, though, so obviously you're still spellbound to some extent, are you not?
It's so stimulating and exciting. You know, and we're like, it's so easy to be fulfilled by adrenaline and erections. These things, you know, that we're animals. As well, we are mammals, although, you know, we have this spark of divinity within us, but this is so easy to yield to the mammalian when that is what's constantly stimulated. You never see a commercial on the TV saying, go home, sit quietly and think about love. That is always, get to the mall and buy something else, you idiot. You know, that'll work it out for you. No one's coming on my TV set and saying, it's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. It's all going to pass. It's all an illusion. We're in infinite space sitting on a rock. We're all alive. The miracle of life is enough. Protect the planet. Protect one another. These ideas are not popularised because they don't make nobody money.
I'm asking you to sit by and listen quietly to this show. It's The Treatment. My guest is Russell Brand. His new book, his new memoir, is Bookie Wook 2. This time it's personal. But I'm thinking, as you talk about this, one of the first times you talk about betrayal, which is when you go out with a woman and she basically kind of throws herself at you, and she ends up reporting on the entire spectacle of being out with you. And that was your one of your first big real kinds of sort of taste of stardom and also being betrayed, seduced by somebody who had an agenda.
Yeah, that was really crazy, Elvis. I am like, sort of, when I got famous, it was like the keys to the citadel. You know, it's like suddenly, you know, that sort of like my primal sexual desires were, I was able to fulfill them almost as soon as I have them. Like being famous is crazy if you've got an addictive nature because, like, you know, I have a lot of libido, I have a lot of life force, right? So, like, and I think a lot of that outlet was sexual. Like, you know, I really, really love women. I love them. You know, so like, and when I first got famous, women became accessible to me. Women would like approach me and present themselves to me, and it's like, oh my God, I can sleep with these women. And when I was a kid, I was fat and chubby and I didn't feel attractive and I weren't good at sport at school, and suddenly I was presented with all these girls. It was amazing. It was so exciting, so exciting. So like, you know, that, and that was, yeah, and I suppose that was one of the first time I encountered, oh wow, this is what it's going to be like being famous. People are going to talk about me, you know, you lose intimacy.
And you had Jonathan Ross sort of admonishing you about that.
Jonathan Ross, yeah, he's sort of like he's a very famous talk show host in the UK. He's like our Letterman, our Leno, our Conan all rolled into one. And like he sort of said, like when I first got famous, his going on his show was a significant contributory factor in becoming famous in the UK. He said, how are you coping with it? He must have seen I looked bruised and battered at the foothills of fame. I said, yeah, I feel strange, Jonathan. And he goes, well, that's because when you get famous, you lose something and you never get it back. And the thing he was referring to, I think, was you are extracted from yourself. You become an avatar of you is extracted. And that avatar is judged and you are judged by its standards. But, you know, the tabloid press works monosyllabically. They've not got room for nuance. Someone said to me, tyranny is the deliberate removal of nuance. You know, that people, that life is confusing. Enlightenment, someone else said to me, is contingent on being able to simultaneously hold two contradictory ideas.
But in the book, you sort of say you were almost amused by how surprised you were about the way you were treated in the media.
Yeah, like it's fascinating to watch yourself, but you know, archetypes, stereotypes, these things exist for a reason, to help with simple narratives. Folk tales and fairy tales across the globe conform to a certain formula because these narratives are resonant and relevant to our souls. You know, so like, but like, and this works in our dreams, in our folk tales, and in our media. We need stories. We need to be told stories. The stories we tell ourselves of ourselves, and the stories the media tell us of ourselves. And I became the gadabout, the cad, the bounder, the womanizer. That was the stereotype that I fulfilled. And I was sort of all right to do that for a while, and I had no control of it. It wouldn't matter if I, you know, what my opinion of it was, because it was, I was not part of it. I was not consensual. You're extracted from yourself. Look at the way, like, you know, sort of Britney Spears, Lindsay Lohan, these poor tragi femmes, you know, the way that they're used in the media, the way that sort of we celebrate their decline and their downfall, you know, like this sort of international suicide watch handing them the blade, you know, sort of like, you know, it's like used for stimulation and titillation. We sort of like, we extract the idea that Britney Spears is a human being with a soul. Lindsay Lohan is a human. That is someone's daughter. Give her love, this poor girl. She's unhappy. Help her. Help her.
Yeah, I'll let you do that. By the way, the you I'm talking to is Russell Brand. His new book, his second memoir, is Bookie Wook 2. This time it's personal. It's a treatment, which you can also hear at kcrw.com. It's funny because we were talking about this. I can't not mention near the end of the book when you find somebody who in a lot of ways sort of takes your measure, as she did at the MTV Awards. As you're drinking a water bottle, I'm thinking she threw a bottle of water at you. You kind of found that, obviously, at least some kind of solace with Katy Perry.
Yeah, that's extraordinary. I think falling in love is the most spectacular yet ordinary thing that two people can do. That it's for its participants, it's so marvelous and wonderful and all consuming, and it happens every day, and it can happen to any of us, and it can happen at any time because it's ever present. It's the awakening of something that's there already, you know, and yeah, she's. It's been lovely. It's for me, she is a lovely way to connect with everything else. Like she's so beautiful and so real and authentic and talented and fun and daft and brilliant and difficult to deal with, and reminds me that I have to compromise, and reminds me constantly that I'm not the most important thing in the world because she is. It's a good thing to be reminded of.
But she flung a water bottle.
Oh yeah, how I met her was at the MTV VMA Awards last year at Radio City Hall, New York, and it was the day before before the big show. And I was hosting the awards, and there was a group of men watching me, the director, the producer, my friends, Big Danny, my partner, Nick, men. I was holding court. I was the jester king, making gags and japes, and everyone was laughing at me. And I'd been the MTV top brass had said, look, Russell, Katy Perry, I think she's going to help introduce you on show, and she's in the same hotel as you. You, as we all know, are a legendary womanizer, a swordsman, devastating with your libido. Please, please do not infect this beautiful, sweet young girl with your marvellous charisma. Then, you don't seduce Katy Perry, said the director. Oh, well, I can make no promises on that score, for I am a bounder, a cad. You must have seen me in the papers. And then arcing across the room from maybe 40 yards away came a half-full or half-empty water bottle, depending on your perspective. It struck me on the head. I turned to view the trajectory, and there, you know, a considerable distance away was Katie. And I thought, like, initially, Elvis, I was annoyed, I'll be honest, because I don't like, you know, when you sort of stub a toe or like, and you have to, or trip over in public and you have to pretend it was deliberate and that you're not bothered by it. I was bothered by it. I didn't like being hit on the head in front of my friends. I thought I was being funny, you know, I was being kind of vain and narcissistic and sort of like a Cupid in a riot. She struck me with a bottle and I was suddenly brought back to reality, or further from it than I've ever been. I'm still not sure. And I like, looked at her and, like, you know, she sort of came towards me. And I think what the word is, badinage, is it? You know, a sort of a playful banter between the two of us. She says something witty, I respond with something witty. The two of us fencing with language. And, like, I felt all strange, this feeling in my stomach. I felt overwhelmed. I felt hot and sort of fizzy and peculiar. And this biliousness, this nausea, but not a negative nausea. This sort of awakening, like the cracking of a sort of a shell around me. You know, we sort of continued to chat. And, like, I noticed this sort of, she had this a bracelet on her wrist, and she sort of took it off and gave it to me, and then we went up onto the stage. I made a really good joke. Here is this really good joke I made, because this is, you know, it's Radio City Hall. It's a 5,000 seater venue, but there's a couple of hundred people, crew and whatnot, scattered around. Crew are the hardest audience. They ain't ready to laugh at anything. They're already bored. So like they're all standing there, and she sort of, and as she introduces me, I'm raised up on a hydraulic lift. I march down the stairs, careful with every step not to fall and tumble and reveal my frailty. And like, as I sort of walk forward, Katie doing the introduction says, she's doing the song We Will Rock You, the Queen song, and she says, here he is, the biggest queen I've ever met, Russell Brand. Oh, ha, 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 she undermined me. I walk to the front of the stage. She's too is on a hydraulic stage, and as I sort of take this as a stage and take to the mic, the hydraulic lift is lowering, so Katie is slowly, slowly being lowered below the eye level, right? And I go, thank you for that introduction, Katie. And now, in a chilling foreshadow of the next 12 months, Katy Perry disappears without trace. Like that. Winning. Winning, in my view, the entire argument. Then afterwards, she sort of came up to me, and I had to give her that bracelet back, you know. I didn't want to. I wanted to keep it because it was a token, a talisman of a feeling I felt in my tummy. So I sort of thought, oh, I'll give her that thing back, because otherwise I'll feel like I've nicked it, stolen it in your language. So I goes, oh, here you go. Here's that thing. And she goes, oh, keep it to remind you of me. I said, oh, I don't need anything to remind me of you. And then I was in love, and that was it.
Yeah. And with that, we're out of time. Russell, anytime you want to come back, you know you're more than welcome here.
Thank you very much, Elvis. Thank you for being so accommodating. It's always an honor to speak with you.
Oh, my pleasure. My guest is Russell Brand. His newest book is Bookie Wook 2, This Time It's Personal. Our recording engineer in NPR West is Leo DeLagula. The show is edited and mixed by J.C. Swadek. Jim and Dempsey's the producer. I'm the Elvis hip hop doesn't want. It's the treatment.
An audio archive of this and other programs can be found at kcrw.com. The treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.